Making an honest man out of David Musto is a great place to start. I would love to start there.
I had known David for many years. He was a resident at Yale a few years after me. I completed my residency there in 64. I think he completed his in the late 60s. And David was very interested early on in history, and especially history of addiction. But one thing that David had never done, he had never treated an addict. I'm not sure he'd even seen an addict. And he came to me in the, I think it was the early to mid 80s, and said, "Herb, I'm having trouble paying my salary. Could I do any grant writing or anything for you guys that will help bring in part of my salary?" And I said, "David, my young people have forgotten more about writing grants than you know. I mean, you've never written a grant. But I'm thinking of starting an upscale methadone program because we have a long waiting list for methadone. And I feel bad every time I have to turn people down. I feel bad. Maybe we can start an upscale methadone program where we will charge enough money, we can make money, and then use the money we make to subsidize slots in our free program. And I think if you ran that clinic, it would give it a certain degree of class." And he said, "Herb, but I've never treated an addict. It's been quite a while since I even saw a psychiatric patient." And I said, "Don't worry. We'll always have one of our people at your side who knows more about addiction and treatment, but you'll be the face of the clinic." And indeed, we opened up that clinic. We gave it a fancy name. It was located on Park Street in New Haven, which is somewhat of a seedy street, but so we call it the Park Avenue or the Park Street Clinic. And David was ahead for about a year and a half, and enjoyed himself very much doing it, did a good job running it. There were no clinical problems or anything because we had a good group of young psychiatrists and psychologists handling it on a day-to-day basis. And then as the clinic grew, it was taking more and more of his time, and he felt that really wasn't his interest. And so we then simply kept him on and paid part of his salary as part of our advisory board. Mm-hmm. But so I say I made an honest man out of David because he'd been writing all these books about addiction and he never really dealt with addicts.
Yes, yes. Well, that is a wonderful story.
And you read his interview with Harry Anslinger.
Oh, yes. Where
he came up with that number of addicts.
Yes.
Because that's one of my favorite quotes. When Anslinger was asked by David, "Sir, in all the years you were head of BNDD, about 30 years, the number of addicts was always between 40,000 and 60,000. Why didn't you commission some scientists to get a more accurate number?" He said, "Son, you don't understand Washington. If I come in with a number lower than 40,000, they're going to say, Anslinger doesn't need as much of his budget, cut the budget. If I come in with more than 60,000, they'll say, Anslinger isn't doing his job, fire the son of a bitch." And so the safe thing to do in Washington is just keep the number of addicts between a stated number. So God knows how many addicts there were
in
the United States
really,
at that time.
Yes. Luckily, we have historical demographers like David Corbett who can count. All right, so where I'd like you to start, it's not my usual way of starting, but it was your way of starting, I think, is to go back to Lexington and to characterize for me how ideas for research arose at Lexington. First, tell me how you got there, that story. And you were running the detox unit, is that what you
That's
were doing
correct.
There? And what relationship did the detox unit have to research? I know a fair amount about research at Lexington, but nothing whatever about the detox unit or really
the
clinical program.
Remember, Lexington was unique. The saying is it was more of a prison than most hospitals and more of a hospital than most prisons. It's the only prison I know of that combined federal prisoners doing between 1 and 10 years, and volunteers. You could sign yourself in. And roughly of the 1,000 people there, roughly 1/3 were volunteers, who, because there's really no other treatment available for addiction in the United States at that time, would sign themselves in. Often many of them were under pressure. We had physicians whose medical board said, you got to get out of Lexington and get treated. So we had physicians and dentists and nurses and pharmacists, as well as ordinary people who had trouble with drugs and there was no other treatment. I got there by accident. In those days, they were drafting doctors out of their training. But if you agreed to go in after your residency, they agreed to let you finish your residency, and you could either sign up for the Army or the Public Health Service. I was doing research at the time. I had my own laboratory in medical school, and I was doing research during my residency, and so I convinced the powers that be that when I went in, I would spend my 2 years at NIMH doing research. And to make a very long story short, when a few months before I was to go on active duty, I get a letter saying, we look forward to seeing you July 1st. You've been assigned to the Public Health Service Hospital at Lexington, Kentucky. So I called and said, there must be some mistake. You know, you promised NIMH. And they said, well, go down to NIMH, see if they still want you. And they did. And so I called Washington again. They said, well, that's fine. Just tell NIMH to send someone to Lexington in your place. They didn't want me that bad. And so I spent 2 years there at Lexington. And many of the great names in addiction spent time at Lexington. George Valiant was there when I was there. Jerry Jaffe had been there before me. Marie Nicewander, who was one of the pioneers in methadone maintenance. Everett Ellingwood, who's done superb work with the stimulants, and many, many others had spent time in the clinical part of Lexington, not the research part, not the part that was Harris Isbell and Abe Wickler and John Ball. That was exist in a different universe. There really was no connection between the two. The division I was in charge of, the admission and detoxification unit, was responsible for screening all the patients and prisoners that came to the facility. For the prisoners, the job was basically to evaluate them, see whether they needed detox, most did not, and to try and figure out what kind of treatment they should receive. For the volunteers, it was to make sure that they were appropriate for the facility, and most of them did need detoxification. And so we would evaluate them, and then the first 30 days would be on the detoxification unit, and then they would go into what we call population, where they lived in units, and they could be in individual therapy, they could be in group therapy, or for many of them, since there was an enormous shortage of both of those, they were basically in milieu therapy, which was they were there and away from drugs, and there were AA meetings if they wanted to attend.
There were.
But there was always a problem with that, because there was Lexington's also the only co-ed place I know of. And so the guys were always trying to get over to the women, and the women were always trying to get over to the guys. And at AA meetings, you know, there were always guards were complaining that they didn't have the time to, you know, supervise to keep the men away from the women there. And so sometimes if you wanted to go to an AA meeting, they'd say, well, we don't have a guard to escort you to that. So
the women were in a separate building?
That's correct.
Was there a name for it?
Probably, but
you don't remember
it. I don't remember it. The person who would know the name, if you want to call them, would be Fred Glazer.
Fred Glazer? Oh,
yes.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Don Jasinski.
No.
Okay.
Now, because Don was in the ARC, the research part.
So
now,
really, Fred it was not separate.
Fred Glaser was head, it was like myself. He was in the same two-year contingent as I was, and he ran the women's unit.
Oh.
So he'll know if they were their special name. And there was a third division of Lexington. So you had ARC, you had men's population, women's population, then you had something called Cobb Hall, K-O-L-B,
mm-hmm.
named after Lawrence Cobb, mm-hmm. who was the first administrator or head. And that was not for addicts. That was for the Coast Guard. The Public Health Service was the medical arm of the Coast Guard. And so Coast Guard people who needed psychiatric help were treated there. And so George, ironically, who became one of the most famous of our alumni, had nothing to do with addicts. He just got interested in addicts because he was at Lexington and decided to do his follow-up studies, which they turned down.
Now, yeah, tell me about they and the process by which research projects were. Did you go through some sort of an internal review board? What was that like?
Yes. If you were not connected with the ARC, the Addiction Research Center, but you wanted to do research, there was an internal board that you had to go through to get permission from. ARC had its own review board, and we had nothing to do with that. The only connection I had with ARC was going over there, attending some of their seminars, and when I had questions about some of the research ideas I had, I would go and speak to Bill Martin or Abe Wickler. Abe had just left and had gone over to the University of Kentucky, but he came back and was there frequently.
What were those conversations like?
Well, they were wonderful because these were people who were both very knowledgeable about addiction and very giving. They were delighted to see some of us two-year wonders who were actually interested in research. And so they wanted to be as helpful as possible. And they always were.
So there wasn't a clinical basic divide in their minds.
Well, their research was not clinical. The ARC still had the mindset of trying to develop, you know, the non-addicting analgesic, which was one of the reasons it was developed. But also it was trying to learn more about various drugs. Methadone, for example. After World War II, the patent for methadone was taken over from the Germans. And a lot of the original research was done at ARC. And ARC did not really understand the drug. And so if you go back and read the early papers, you see they would put people on 300, 350 milligrams of methadone and then abruptly stop. They had no idea what appropriate doses were or the methadone withdrawal. And so let me go back a step. When I came to Lexington, I knew practically nothing about addiction. In fact, that may be an exaggeration. I knew nothing about addiction. I had done some work with students at Yale who used psychedelic drugs, but I had never seen a heroin addict, at least that I knew of. So I spent my first 2 months there reading practically everything I can get my hands on in their library so I can learn about addiction. And that's where I came across some of these wonderful old papers. About methadone, about some of the other drugs that they were researching. And it was fascinating. But they weren't, and they developed scales to measure the effects of different drugs, because how do you know what a new drug is like? Is it a psychedelic? Is it a sedative? Is it a narcotic? And so Chuck Harrison there developed a variety of scales to try and figure out. And so, you know, you had a scale, a morphine scale. You had basically a LSD-like scale. And you had drugs that may have tested positive on those scales that had nothing to do with those drugs.
Mm-hmm.
but some of the effects were of that ilk. But basically, and I guess John Ball was interested, as was John O'Donnell, in doing some of the sociological research at the time. But there was practically no, I don't know if there was any treatment research going on at the time there at ARC. At least nothing that occurs to me.
And you would have known if there was.
I probably would have known, yes. And I certainly do not know of any.
Right.
Take it back. I mean, for example, Abe Wickler was very interested in craving, in conditioned craving. Mm-hmm. What would get someone to relapse after you would withdraw them? And so he studied the whole role of cues. Mm-hmm. The work of Chuck O'Brien. Chuck sees himself very much as a linear descendant of Abe Wickler's work as far as studying conditioned cues and craving and relapse. So in that sense, yes, there was that kind of clinical research. But if you mean ways to improve individual therapy or group therapy or even to develop medications for therapy, no.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't see methadone as a pharmacotherapeutic agent.
They saw methadone as a pharmacotherapeutic agent for withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And so that was the drug we used to withdraw people who had opiate problems, just like we used phenobarb, for example, to withdraw people who were addicted to the barbiturates. Mm-hmm. Cocaine really didn't need much withdrawal, but you didn't have much cocaine back in the 60s.
So the detox unit, you were using these, you would use the appropriate pharmacotherapy,
right.
I see. Okay. And by the time you got there, did they have appropriate doses of methadone? I mean, was that established? It was a fairly routine procedure,
yes,
by then.
Yes. The first paper I recall from ARC on Lexington was like on methadone was 1948. It was a paper by Isabel. So this is now 1964. So yes, they had worked out with using methadone for opiate withdrawal. Mm-hmm. You know, what were the appropriate doses and all that. I mean, one of my favorite anecdotes, we evaluated all the patients when they came in and decided what they needed for withdrawal. And I remember I was examining a patient, and the orderly came running in and said, "Hey, doc, the guy in the next room waiting to see you is starting to have a seizure. He must be a barb addict." So I said, "Well, get me a tourniquet, get me some IV amitol." I go in the next room, and this guy's having a classic grand mal seizure.
Oh, wow.
And so I whip the tourniquet around his arm, preparing to give him some amitol. The guy looks up and said, "There's no good veins in that arm. Try the next one," and then goes back to having a seizure again.
So. It's sort of like when my 4-year-old says, "I'm going to have a tantrum."
Right.
Like, if you're that rational now. That's great.
These guys were wonderful, mimicking things. He could was one of the best grand mal seizures I've ever seen.
That's great.
So you developed a great appreciation for the humanity of these patients, their intelligence, their wit, their abilities to outsmart you, and I found that I enjoyed working with them. Mm-hmm. And the first, you asked earlier about the research committee. George had wanted to do a follow-up study on people who were treated at Lexington. And his first study was going to be on people who had been treated there 10 years earlier. And he planned to follow them up. Well, the review committee said, "You'll never be able to find them." And so refused to give him permission, which meant that he had to use his own vacation time to go try and track them down, which he did. And because if you were at Lexington, you had a FBI number. So it wasn't that hard to track them down. But he was probably halfway done before they agreed that, yes, he would be able to find them and let him take time off from work to go track them down and not have to charge it to his vacation time. When I was at Yale, I'd had a lot of students who were involved with psychedelic drugs, and my first research papers, in fact, were on psychedelic drug use among Yale students. And we were very discouraged at the time about what happened to addicts who left Lexington. In general, the data was that over 90% relapsed back to heroin in the first 30 days. So one of my thoughts was, well, maybe I could combine the interest in psychedelic drugs and see could they be used as a therapy. Because at that time, the research on psychedelic drugs as therapy was really split. People who had personal experience themselves thought that the therapy was terrific. Not so much on addicts, but on in general. People who had not tried the drugs, but were just giving it, said that it was worthless. And so I thought I would do the perfect ABBA design, and that I would have a group of patients who would have the experience, and I would be running the group, and as someone who had not taken it, it was controlled. That is, I had an active placebo. Half the group got LSD, and the other half got dexedrine, and it was double blind, so I had no idea who got what. And then I figured after they finished, I would repeat it with a new group of patients, only I would take LSD in between so that I would have experience with the effects. Well, never got to that. I never took the LSD, and I never got to the second half, because as I was finishing the first half, Sandoz recalled the LSD because it had become a street drug, and they didn't want their reputation tainted by being connected with it. So I thought, okay, I can't, there's no legitimate research purpose anymore to doing this. I can't justify my taking it now on for research purposes. I could justify out of curiosity. I didn't think that was a good enough reason, and so I didn't. You know, I didn't take the LSD. And I never published results, of course, from the study, because I never did the second half.
Right, but that was a study that you got approved then at Lexington.
Yes.
That was the study you talked about in the lecture.
Yes.
Okay.
And the George taught me that George never got his approved until he joined the committee. His word of advice to me was, Herb, because I was having trouble getting mine approved, he said, the best way to do it is get on the committee. And I did, and that's how I got mine approved.
All right. Wonderful. So tell me then, are there other stories about Lexington, other things that I should know about it as a clinical research environment, as a place?
Well, the majority of people there were not engaged in research, either staff or patients or prisoners, I'm not sure what you want to call them. They were engaged in one of the trades. Lexington was called the farm because it was a farm. We produced our own milk, our own meat. We had a number of prison industries. You know, they
yes.
made tables, they made prison, they made
sewing
uniforms.
In fact, in the archives, in the National Archives, there's a letter from Singer Sewing Machines about Lawrence Cobb saying, this man has never run a needleworks. You know, he doesn't know anything about sewing.
Well,
so that stuff was how people kept busy.
That's how they kept busy during the day. Everyone was in a trade. And in fact, I used that when I did the LSD therapy. That is, in addition to getting ratings from my therapist, you know, the psychologist who would see these people, I would also get ratings from their work supervisors. I would say, so-and-so is in a research project that I'm carrying out. They had no idea what the project was. Could you tell me whether you've noticed anything different in terms of how he behaves? on a day-to-day basis. And then I gave a number of items I would want them to rate the patient on, you know, diligence at work, you know, did he seem to be behaving strangely, et cetera. And I remember some of my best LSD experiences, and before they had changed, were from people when you broke the blind turned out to have been on Dexedrine. But there were some wild experiences. One guy made a mistake of not checking what they were serving for dinner. And they were serving for dinner that night spaghetti. And the spaghetti became snakes. Crawling off the plate.
Oh. I probably won't be able to get over that image.
And, you know, and the guy stood up in a chair because the spaghetti was coming after him. Another one tried to break down a door because he was hallucinating that his girlfriend was on the other side of it and we were keeping her from him. So this is a potent class of drugs. I mean, the good news is nothing bad happened in terms of these were temporary aberrations. And there was no lasting kind of effects. Some of the lasting effects, I mean, there are no lasting adverse effects. There was one patient I remember who did have a sort of a personality change under the LSD. Before that, he always had what we would call, you know, excuse the language, you know, a shit-eating grin on his face. That's how he faced the world, with that sort of passive-aggressive style. And after the therapy, he quit smiling like that. And he tended to be much more somber. But when I would point that out to him, he would insist that nothing had changed. And he indeed had had the active drug. So it's a little difficult to figure out what these agents do, but they are potent. They are potent. In terms of what else was going on Lexington, they were doing marijuana research. They showed, for example, that if you took extracts of marijuana, of THC, that you can make anyone psychotic. It was only a dose phenomenon.
At that point, what would you say were the prevailing conceptualizations or definitions of addiction? Because, I mean, Lexington is interesting because you had Lawrence Cobb and you had psychopathology and then you had Abe Wickler and you had physical dependence and having to reconcile.
And conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
At the turn of the century, you know, around 1900 and 1910, addiction was primarily seen as physical dependence. And the belief was that if you could treat the physical dependence, you were treating the addiction. And so a number of so-called cures came about during that period of time. And what this meant was that if we detoxified you, we had cured you of your addiction. Now, if you relapsed, that's because you're a bad person. You know, you've chosen now to become an addict. When you are in the throes of physical dependence, you may not have free will and choice and all that, but we've taken care of that. We've detoxed you, and you've had the temerity to relapse. And so if you review the history of detox at that period, and the best paper on that is up to the I think the 30s or 40s was Cobb and Himmelsbach, and then I updated their paper and reviewed the whole history of the narcotic withdrawal from the turn of the century to about 1980. And I did that because we had just developed clonidine for opiate withdrawal at Yale. And I felt that some of my young people were, you know, acting inappropriately. They felt they had discovered the greatest thing since sliced bread. And I decided they needed to know about the history of narcotic withdrawal, that sliced bread had been repeatedly
yes.
discovered, only to turn out often that it was worse than what you were trying to treat. In fact, that's how I forget whether I started a paper like that or ended it, that you know, the history of the treatment of narcotic withdrawal is a long and sort of dismal one, filled with cures that turned out to be worse than the disease they were trying to treat. And that therefore anyone who tells you that they have the treatment for narcotic withdrawal or for narcotic addiction should put it forth with modesty and be regarded with skepticism until you have proof. I mean, you had one drug they published, I think it was Narcosin, that, or that killed 3 out of the 12 people in the study. And they, they had recommendations about who it was good for, and my take was, you give it to people you don't like.
Right.
But I felt that that was important because basically the history of narcotic addiction in the first half of the 20th century was trying different ways of basically doing withdrawal. So everything that came along in psychiatry or medicine, thyroid hormone gets discovered, they try thyroid.
Yes.
ECT gets discovered, they try ECT. Insulin coma therapy gets tried, they try insulin coma therapy. Serum therapy, they try that, you know, where you take out a person's blood and then spin it down and inject it back into them. There are therapy where you created blisters all over the patient's body, sucked the fluid out of the blisters, and then injected the fluid back into the body.
Where did you find this? Is this Terry and Pellens? I mean,
no, this is much more. This is Kolb and Himmelsbach. In that history of, in their paper on narcotic withdrawal.
But so when you went and wrote the clonidine paper, you were thinking about their paper in particular?
Yes.
Okay.
And basically updating it, you know, adding all the things that happened after their paper, that is, development of Demerol as a non-addicting narcotic.
Yes. It is really amazing when you think about it.
Yes. I mean, we keep making the same
eternal
mistake.
Eternal return.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And ECT, I think, was after them. And, you know, again, and all of these talk about how good their therapy is. And I thought that some of them were very honest about how good it was. ECT paper said, you know, maybe one of the reasons it's good is that after ECT, patients get confused, and therefore they can't sign out AMA too quickly. And so they can be there longer until the withdrawal wears off.
Yeah.
So, if withdrawal is an essential part of target for treating addiction, and then you try and come up with different ways and better ways to do withdrawal, and then why do people relapse once they're addicted, and withdrawn? And that's where you get into Abe Wickler's stuff. They do it because they have, because of conditioning. And, you know, you have both Pavlovian conditioning and the, you know, the Skinnerian conditioning. But it's these conditioned cues that get them to relapse. And then we got to figure out some way to deal with conditioning. And Chuck O'Brien has devoted much of his career to try and figuring out. How do we, in a sense, extinguish these patients? And, you know, without being unfair to Chuck, and you should certainly interview him because he's one of the giants in the field. As far as I can tell now, he's still doing work on that, but it's pretty well agreed that you're not going to extinguish craving, because what happens is, his classic example that he gives is this patient who had been extinguished, where they could show them the condition cues, and nothing would happen on the GSR. And then one day, the guy came in having had an argument with the parking lot attendant, who didn't let him park there that day. And so he comes in all riled up. And now you show him, you expose him. to the condition cues, and his scores go off the chart. So clearly extinction was not terribly useful in a vacuum, because it seemed to be overridden by intense emotional states. So when I left Lexington, I don't know, should I just continue or ask me questions?
Well, whatever. I wanted to ask you about, I mean, you, Lexington, you've said, marked you, and you left it. And one of the things that you found yourself in the position of doing later was being on the advisory council at a time when the ARC was basically being shut down.
Yes.
And so I wondered if you could talk about both that role, but then also your own sense of, did that represent a loss to the field? Or how do you think about that?
Well, the reason that the ARC was going to be shut down was because of episodes like the Tuskegee scandal. And Congress got very upset, and rightfully so, as did the scientific community, about the whole idea of doing research with people who didn't know what was going on with the research, or who really were not free to choose to participate. And they made it very hard to do research on prisoners. And since most of the people taking part at Lexington in the research were prisoners, not to volunteers, because the incentives weren't there for volunteers. The main incentive for taking part in the research at Lexington was that you could get good time, which meant you could get out of prison earlier. The volunteers were volunteers.
Yes.
They didn't need to get out of prison earlier. And so if you couldn't use prisoners, there weren't going to be enough addicts in Lexington, Kentucky to keep ARC able to do productive research. So it had to be moved. And it became a political football, because you had a lot of money and a lot of federal jobs at stake. And so you had Congress trying to move it to places that would have been totally inappropriate. It's Senator Byrd putting a FBI fingerprinting center in West Virginia. Not because that's the best place for that, so far away from Washington where the other FBI resources are, but because it brought jobs to West Virginia. And we had similar kinds of things with Lexington, where people wanted to move it to places simply as a job creation experience. The council felt very strongly, one, that it should be moved to a place where it could have affiliation with a strong academic center, a medical school. Two, it should be in an area where there were plenty of addicts, which meant a major metropolitan area, not some rural area. And the area right outside of Baltimore where the ARC is now situated was excellent for that point of view. It made it possible for it to be connected with Johns Hopkins, which is a very distinguished medical school and has been doing distinguished research in drug abuse for decades. My late wife, Dr. Fishman, spent 8 years at Hopkins. And there are some wonderful researchers there now, you know, George Bigelow, Maxine Stitzer, Roland Griffith, Don Jasinski, et cetera. So it was a good choice, and was also close enough to the NIH campus, although it's, you know, it's an hour away, but it's not 3 hours away.
Yeah.
You know, you can drive between the two as long as you don't do it at rush hour.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But so it was a good choice, and I'm proud that council made that choice. I mean, one of the ironies of life is how politics in this country works. The fact that I'm even on council, was even on council in those days.
How did that happen?
NIDA never had a council. NIDA had just been developed. In the 60s, The NIMH had responsibility for drug and alcohol problems. And they really wanted to get rid of it because their fears were that both drug and alcohol research was sexy and that Congress would lean on them to put more of their funds into drug and alcohol research. So they didn't want any parts of it. And they had a separate division of for alcohol and drugs. Mm-hmm. And then came SAADAP, Special Action Office, under President Nixon. And as SAODAP wound down, the decision was made to convert that into a new institute, National Institute on Drug Abuse, and at the same time to create a National Institute on alcohol and alcohol abuse, and IAAA. So then you and so the three brain institutes, so to speak, NIMH and NIDA and NIAAA were then combined into something called Adam Haugh. And its director was, I think the first Adam Haugh director, I believe, was Jerry Clareman. Or it may have been Bob, I'm blocking on his name, but Jerry was the one I remember, because Jerry had been one of my mentors at Yale. But although at that time I was doing research at Yale, I had developed a very big program there.
Yes.
And we can go back and talk about that.
68, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But the first council is interesting because
yes.
It's how politics works in the United States. I had never heard of a NIDA council. And I got a call one day from Joe. I figured, patient, father, who knows. So I returned a call, and I said, it's Dr. Kleber returning a call to Joe. And the guy who answered the phone says, Fred's Garage, hey, Joe, there's a doc on the phone who wants to talk to you. So Joe gets on, and I said, this is Dr. Kleber you called. He said, hey, doc, I work with the Republican Town Committee in North Haven, Connecticut, which is where the town I was living at the time. And they want to point you to some group in Washington. And they called me to see if you're okay. And I just want you to know that I told them you were okay. I said, thanks, Joe. And that was a political clearance process of the day. I mean, fortunately, if I'd ever had my car repaired there, I didn't complain about, the bill or about the quality of the work so that Joe could say that I was okay. But that's how, in spite of my research or scientific reputation, I had to be cleared by Joe.
That's great.
And don't think that still doesn't happen.
So the council. What was the council doing at that point?
Well, the director was Bob DuPont. He was the first director of NIDA. And we had a number of issues. We were basically, defining the institute, helping create it, setting priorities. One year, for example, we turned down all prevention grants. Period. Because we decided that none of them really met the standard of good research and that the field needed to hear that if they wanted to get funding from the federal government for prevention research, they had to submit scientifically adequate grants. And after that, the quality of prevention research markedly improved.
When do you think that was?
Probably 77, 78. I was on the council from 75 to 79.
And at that point, the council was defining research priorities.
Along with, of course, the staff of NIDA.
And the director.
And it was an incredible group of people, the council. I mean, some of the greatest names in the field. Avram Goldstein. Richard Bonney. Peter Dews. Those are names that come to mind.
And what do you remember about the priority areas at that point?
Well, you had people fighting about priority areas. We had a wonderful judge from Yakima County, Washington, of Washington State.
Yes.
Very bright lady, and one of her priorities was prevention. She was tired of having all the addicts parading through her court, and she wanted us to do more in prevention. And then you had people like Avram and Peter Dews, who were primarily basic scientists. You had Richard Bonney, who is a lawyer, who is very interested in legal aspects of addiction, as well as treatment. I was primarily a treatment research person, and I wanted research that improved treatment. That's been my passion my whole life, is how do you improve treatment for addiction? So there's all those various competing, but also working together forces. We also try to defend the integrity of the Institute. And nothing's changed, and things just keep going round and around. The controversial grant that comes to my mind was one that a researcher from Illinois had submitted. And they wanted to study the interaction between marijuana and sex. And so the study was that you take individuals and you give them either marijuana or placebos. You expose them to pornographic movies, and these are males, and you wrap a platysmograph around the penis, and you measure penile erection. So you have a constant stimulus, namely the pornographic movie. And then you have one group getting marijuana and the other group getting placebo. Congress had a fit. Proxmire gave it the Golden Fleece Award, award? That he felt were waste of congressional waste of taxpayer dollars. I think he called it the Golden Fleece.
I think they were Golden Fleece. Yeah.
Yes. And the Attorney General from Illinois said, if this man ever does this in my county, I'll arrest him in any subjects. The Congress threatened to withhold money from NIDA's budget if we approved it. But my memory is that counsel thought the science was reasonable and said that Congress should not be making these decisions. Mm-hmm. And we approved it, and we fought for the ability of NIDA to make scientifically credible decisions and not be influenced by the political process. And of course, that's still going on today, those issues. And it doesn't matter very much who's in the White House or which party controls the White House or which party controls Congress any more than it does on funding for treatment. I mean, when I've testified in Congress, what I've often said is that funding for treatment is a bipartisan failure. Mm-hmm. When I served under Bill Bennett and the first President Bush, you had a Republican president and a Democratic-controlled Congress, and the administration did not ask for enough money for treatment, and Congress gave us less than we asked for. And the same thing happened in the 90s when you had a Republican Congress and Democratic president. So that it doesn't matter what political party. I think the Republicans have been a little better on funding for research and treatment, but basically politicians, as I say, no politician ever lost an election by voting against treatment.
Yes.
But try voting against more police or more prisons. Mm-hmm. And your opponent will accuse you of being soft on crime.
How early in your career would you say that you came to recognize that your that was your passion, that treatment research, right? That, and you make many statements about, you know, good clinical research, you know, good treatment, et cetera, go together. When do you think that recognition became apparent to you?
I'm not sure that you create a researcher. I mean, it's you could train a researcher, but I'm not sure you create one. I mean, when I was in college, I was doing research in psychology. In medical school, I was doing research in pharmacology. In neither instance was because I had to, because that was great fun to do it. So, I mean, that's just how my mind works, that I look at things and, you know, 10 different questions arise that I want to try and answer. When I see patients, and I insist that all my clinical staff see patients, no matter how much research they're doing, because if you don't see patients, you don't really know what it is that needs researching. You know, it keeps you humble when you have that human being in front of you and you realize you can't help them adequately.
Do you think that there is enough capacity for doing good clinical research in this country?
I think we don't have enough good researchers, especially MD researchers. I think we have some superb PhD researchers. I think there's a dreadful shortage of MD researchers. And if you look at CPDD, I mean, I think CPDD Council has, I think, 16 members, of only two of whom are MDs, myself and Tom Crowley. So historically, it's been much more of a PhD organization. And yet much of the clinical research needs to be done, you know, by MDs or with people with that background. I mean, PhDs are wonderful. Some of my best researchers are PhDs, and my late wife was, you know, a wonderful researcher and a PhD. But you need both. And it's very hard to hire good MD research. It's very hard to recruit them into the field. The financial incentives work very much against you. And they're not exposed to research for the most part in medical school or residency. Yale was one of the few places where you didn't get out of your residency without doing research. You were required to do research. In fact, that was one of my favorite anecdotes from my residency days. I'm sorry, I was already a faculty member. And it was the late 60s when, you know, the whole zeitgeist was rebellion against authority. And so the residents organized, and they came as a group to meet with the acting chair. And they said, it's unfair that we have to do research and we're not given any time to do it. And we demand that we be given half a day a week to do research, since a research requirement is part of finishing the residency. And the chair listened to him. He said, you know, you're absolutely right. I'm going to tell your ward chiefs that from now on, you would have Saturday morning off to do research. And a big groan goes up, and he says, you mean you're not working Saturday mornings now? I'm going to have to look into that. So, but, you know, yeah, there were a few medical schools that did prize research, but not the majority. Mm-hmm. Yale was one of them, and really not only residency, but medical students were strongly encouraged to do research. But that's not true of most.
And do you think that the... Do you think of it as a gap? I also talk to treatment.
I'm going to hit the men's room.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're drinking all the water.
All right, I'm going to keep this going because I don't know how to stop it and find my place again. And I'm scared to death to lose it. So, transcriber, just, you know, keep. There will be more on this mini disc. Thanks. Wow, he's wonderful.
Questions are wonderful too. Oh, thank you. I've been worried about him because he's so much on public record. You know, so I've been able to read a great deal about his.
Something.
Yes. And so, you know, will he give me anything different from what he's already said is the question.
Well, your questions are probing. I'm not sure. I think
you can. Oh, good. Good. So I understand you're a photographer.
Yes.
I feel like I've now been interviewing, I think, for 5 days straight, and I have one more morning, and I'm so tired of words that I wish I could think in images and do that kind of work. What kind of photography do you do?
I'm an events photojournalist.
Ah.
So for a conference, or an award ceremony, or a wedding, or a round table discussion. Sermon.
Yes.
I'll photograph.
It's probably good they don't know that yet.
Some people do, but I'm off duty.
Yes, right.
This is the first time I even bothered to bring the camera. I thought, not even good, because I thought if I send off a flash, which this would automatically do, I would startle her.
Well, if you tell.
I'm digital.
Yeah. Is that what
it's
is?
Just a, it's just a off the shelf consumer digital.
Yes. Tell me. I'm about to. I'm just an old. I like old SLRs, and I have resisted going digital, and my parents have convinced me I must because of the grandchildren.
It's quite wonderful. I mean, the only thing I have is this. I mean, my professional stuff is conventional photography. Mm-hmm. Film photography, and I got this about a year ago, and for a trip, and I adore it. My family and friends don't get prints anymore; they just get digital stuff.
So you really like that?
I adore it, and you will too, because as soon as you get the images, you upload them, and then you have them, and you can distribute them. Everyone will love it for
yes.
it, and you'll love it, and it's a good way to store things and have them, and be able to show them.
Well, thank you for the encouragement.
Yeah.
Talking photo equipment, thinking about images for a little while
okay.
instead of all these words. All right, what I wanted to go sort of resume with is, could you give me a historical perspective on, I mean, take your career, on that gap between research and treatment? You're somebody who really embodies not a gap. I mean, you embody the combination of it. Have you seen that widen or narrow? What's your perspective on that gap?
The majority of treatment programs in the United States do not carry out the treatment that have been shown by research to be the most effective. Even if they wanted to carry them out, often they would have trouble finding qualified staff who could carry them out. A paper recently done by Tom McClellan and Chuck O'Brien and myself on the staffing of treatment programs in the United States, the whole treatment infrastructure, shows enormous problems there. You have people quitting counselor jobs at methadone programs, director jobs at methadone programs to hire on as prison guards because they get paid more. Less than 5% of the treatment programs we surveyed had a full-time physician. Less than half had any physicians at all. And many of them, what's happened is programs that had physicians hired psychologists, and then psychologists became social workers who became counselors. And as you've degraded the treatment system, you've made it hard to carry out quality treatment. Even many of the people, for example, who staff methadone programs, the counselors, don't believe in methadone. They will they will give the message to patients that, you know, you're taking a drug. We started a buprenorphine program at Columbia about 8 months ago. And we get a number of calls from people who are on methadone programs wanting to switch over to buprenorphine. And because of the pharmacologic properties of buprenorphine, you really have to be at around 40 milligrams of methadone before you can switch over. Otherwise, the withdrawal may be uncomfortable. And so we tell people, you know, you have to tell your program to lower you to 40. And they say, I've asked my program to do that, and they won't do it. I said, well, you may have to lie to them. Don't tell them you want to get on bup. Tell them that the methadone dose is making you sleepy or whatever. Remember now, 60% of all the methadone programs in the United States are for-profit. In California, 90% are for-profit. Well, how do you make money in a methadone program? You don't make money by changing the dose. Methadone's very cheap, maybe 25 cents a day. So you're not going to make any money by giving less methadone. The biggest cost in the methadone program is staffing. So to the extent that you could downgrade the credentials of the staff and increase the caseloads of the staff, that's how you make your money. A chain of methadone programs in California not too long ago sold for $17 million. So I have said, much to the dismay of some of my colleagues, that I would not send my dog to some of the methadone programs in New York City. They are filling stations. Methadone is not, as a medication, it's not a treatment. It has to be given in an appropriate therapeutic context. In fact, that was one of my interesting, embarrassing moments when I was in the White House. I got a call from Mike Isikoff, who was a reporter with the Washington Post, who had the drug beat. I was only on job about a month, and he said, Dr. Kleber, what do you think of this no-frills methadone, which is basically methadone without therapy? And I said, it's a dreadful idea. Explain why. Never occurred to me to ask, why are you asking me this? I assume he's asking me this because I'm an expert on everything. And I hung up, went back to work. Next morning, front page of the Washington Post, above the fold, which is what you always dread. Secretary Sullivan, who was head of HHS at the time, testifies in favor of no-frills methadone. Deputy Drug Czar Kleber says it's a dreadful idea, or a dumb idea, something like that. Sullivan's people called over. They were furious. We had embarrassed their secretary, and they wanted Bennett to call Sullivan and apologize. And so I went to tell Bill what had happened, figuring he'd fire me for being such an idiot. So he said what I told him would happen. He said, well, why are you against it? I told him why. He said, you're absolutely right. Here's what I want you to do. You call Sullivan's people back. You tell them that from now on he is never to testify in Congress on any drug-related issue without clearing his testimony with you first, and we want an apology that he did not do it this time. And we got it. And then I called Lou Sullivan, personally apologized for any embarrassment I may have caused him, and we became good friends. I learned after that to at least ask reporter, why are you asking me this?
Yeah. So tell me about the medications, not treatment thing. Why do you say that?
Okay. In our current state of knowledge, the only cure that medication does is treatment of overdose or treatment of withdrawal. I could cure your opiate withdrawal. I could cure your heroin overdose. That has nothing to do with treating your addiction. So what is the purpose of medication then? One, and I think the major purpose, is to provide a window of opportunity during which you can give the patient the appropriate behavioral help to help them cope with the cravings, the conditioned cues, the vicissitudes of daily life, work on getting a job. You know, as we said, a good job is, we want our patient to get a good job, but some job is better than no job. And it's important that patients work. It's hard enough to keep them off drugs nights and weekends, but if they have 24 hours a day free, it makes it much harder. So there need to be some gainful activity there. Raising children, of course, could be an appropriate activity, but, you know, so they need help with this. Often they don't have any vocational skills. And so they need therapy. The medication can help them cope with drug use during that time. And for a minority of patients, long-term maintenance may be a possibility, such as with methadone or buprenorphine or naltrexone. We're coming to the day, and I expect we'll be there in a decade or so, where we will have vaccines and blockers or maintenance agents for all the major drugs for abuse.
Vaccines?
Yes. Now be careful, because I have started my talks by showing that slide, that within 10 years we will have what I just told you. And the next slide gives the same quote, and it says Cleaver, 1978. So my skills as a prognosticator may not be all that great.
I think I've seen you do that.
But this time I'm close. This time I'm really convinced we're going to have that. I mean, we already have a cocaine vaccine that we're testing at Columbia. We already have a depot naltrexone that lasts 30 days. We're working with the Australians on a naltrexone implant that'll last a year. We're going to have all that very soon. And I expect a nicotine vaccine is going to come along. It's already underway. But then you'll still be left with the issue of, unless you're going to confer lifelong immunity or lifelong blockade, how do you get people to keep taking it? Even if we have a implant that blocks heroin for a year, how do we get people to take it on the 13th month to keep taking it? How do we get them to take a second dose of that vaccine? So that we need to keep in context the human being, and they have to have a reason for wanting to stay away from drugs. Remember, people take drugs for two reasons: to feel good and to feel better. And the people who take it to feel good, we call sensation seekers, etc. They're taking drugs to get high. People who take it to feel better are those that we consider are self-medicators. And unfortunately, the two often meld. People who start by taking it to self-medicate may discover they really like the high, and the people who take it to get high may develop depression or other psychological problems. But drugs mimic what's going on in the brain. I've never had to talk a patient out of taking strychnine. I've never had a patient tell me they did not like their heroin or cocaine or methamphetamine. They may not like what the addiction does to them, the way it's crippled their life, lost their job, lost their family. But that doesn't mean they don't like the drug. And so we have to give them alternative ways to feel good about themselves. Or as Freud said, the ability to work and to love, to feel good in interpersonal relationships, and from some meaningful activity that they can get some pleasure out of.
All right. I want to ask a question that I don't have fully formed, but it has to do with psychoanalysis and the dominance of psychoanalysis, psychopathology, psychiatric explanations in the field, and the sort of fortunes of those kinds of explanations across the 20th century. Where are we now with those kinds of explanations? And
in addiction, in the late 30s, you had Sanford Rado talking
yes.
about the repetition compulsion.
I write about him.
yes.
No one else writes about him.
About Rado? Yes, well, a lot of those great old-timers are forgotten, unfortunately. Reich was probably closer to the truth in his book on character analysis. Kind of that's probably more of our addicts are, you know, would have character pathology rather than symptom neuroses. I think what we know now is that addiction is a brain disease. It doesn't mean it started that way. But it means once you're there, it doesn't matter how it started. So going, you know, so even if the analysts were right about how people got involved with addiction because of various disturbances in their childhood, in some sense that's irrelevant. I mean, if I take a lit cigarette and I put it on the back of my hand, I create a burn. I yank away the cigarette. I have now taken away the root cause of the burn. Does that heal the burn? No. The burn may get infected. It may fester. I may need an antibiotic. And it's the same with addiction. That addiction may have started because of psychiatric problems, but once you have those brain changes, it doesn't matter why it started. You have to treat the addiction. Now, does that mean you can ignore everything else? No, because if you ignore the psychiatric or psychological pathology and the whole environmental set in which the patient operates, then no matter what else you do with the addiction, relapse is likely to occur. So that if you need to do both, if on the other hand you only treat the psychological problems and you don't treat the addiction, you're never going to get the person clean. They're not going to stop using. And that was one of AA's great contributions was, you know, unfortunately it went too far, but, you know, which was, you got to stop the drinking or the drugging. It's very hard to treat someone who continues to use. It doesn't mean you don't try. I mean, you know, my own feeling is that, as I tell my patients, I will treat you as long as you keep coming. If you lose the ability to pay me, I will treat you for free. But you got to keep coming. And if you keep coming, you will get help. And we will hang in there together. But you have to treat that addiction. And you have to give them the tools to cope with that. At this point, the main drug we're missing, and I don't know if we'll ever be able to do that, is one that makes it possible to be a virgin again. That is the work of Nora Volkoff in her imaging work, the work of Eric Nessler in his intracellular work has shown that profound changes do occur and persist. And it's those changes that often are related to relapse. For example, with heroin addiction, you have persistent, protracted withdrawal that goes on for at least 9 months, maybe longer. It's manifested not physically, but psychologically. By irritability, trouble concentrating. Hell, when I gave up smoking, I smoked 2 packs a day for 25 years. I've been clean now for, you know, about almost 30 years now. I had trouble writing a paper or a grant for 6 months. And giving up smoking was one of the hardest things I've ever done. In fact, I start my medical student lectures that way, which leads them to boo me, of course. I say, you know, the two most difficult things I've ever done are give up smoking and vote once for a Democrat for president. And I'm still glad I gave up smoking. And of course, being good New York liberals, they boo.
Yes.
And so I said, well, you know, you guys remind me of that old Dorothy Parker line, that lecturing to students is casting fake pearls in front of real swine. And they boo again. I said, okay, now let's get back to work, back to science, and let's talk about why giving up addiction is so hard. And what do we know about those brain changes? And, you know, with cocaine, it looks like it's very much having to do with changes in dopamine receptors, with how you get pleasure. You know, because the pleasure these drugs cause is intense. If you ever saw the movie Trainspotting, remember the hero or anti-hero when he's asked, you know, why do you keep using heroin when you get into so much trouble? What is the answer?
I actually don't remember.
He says, think of the best orgasm you ever had, and then multiply it by 1,000.
And that actually, Sandra Rado had that theory down.
Yes. Yes, he had it 70 years ago.
Yeah. So, the pharmacothemic orgasm.
Yeah.
So you've witnessed a fair amount of.
Yeah, so that the psychoanalytic therapy has not been terribly useful in treating addiction. In fact, that's probably an overstatement. It hasn't been useful in treating addiction. You know, I know too many horror stories. You know, people have been on the couch 4 times a week for years while still using drugs. I mean, I have a patient who, an investment banker who was in analysis for 10 years and continued to use the drugs. And he's now been off drugs for 3 years, and he is so angry still at the fact that he didn't get to me until 3 years ago, and that his addiction was totally ignored. He was still in, you know, an analysis, trying to figure out the root causes, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he's doing terrific now.
Yeah.
But at some point, I mean, the Holy Grail is the discovery of drugs that will reverse the brain changes. So if we say that heroin use, you know, changes the brain, if we say that cocaine use changes the brain, and that they change the intracellular structure, what happens if we had a medication that repaired that? What happens if the stem cell research enables it to repair that?
You're speculating, or you?
I'm speculating. I think it's ultimately possible, probably not in my lifetime. I mean, I could say in 10 years.
Yeah, really?
And then you'll write it up, and then I'll be able to make a slide out of it. And then I will say Kleber, you know, 2004, and in 2014, people say, what kind of idiot, you know, were you?
Yeah. Well, the humility and the modesty is interesting. You have witnessed a great deal of conceptual shift, definitional shift, methodological models, etc. Would you say now that you've sort of stabilized on this? I mean, you believe that this brain changes in structure and function were there, that we are stabilized.
Okay. I'm sorry, repeat.
You sound pretty convinced of the structural and functional brain changes, persistent, irreversible. And yet, you know this field, you've witnessed a great deal of shift in this field over your being time of involvement with it.
Yes.
Are you now pretty convinced that things have kind of stabilized?
I mean, do I think we now have the right theories? Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no. The evidence looks fairly convincing, but I was on a beach the other day here, and a fellow came up to talk to me. He had been a patient in our therapeutic community in 1970. After graduating, he married one of the women that had been in treatment with him. They'd been married now 31 years.
He recognized you?
Yes,
on
he
beach?
Was looking for me.
Ah.
He was looking for me.
So he's here at the meeting?
He's here at the meeting. He has a poster. He has a poster today. He's now the director of one of the largest treatment programs in Connecticut. In fact, I'm sure he'd be happy to have his name identified if you wanted to talk to him. Pat McAuliffe, McAuliffe. In fact, I'm encouraging Pat to join CPDD, even though he doesn't have the appropriate degrees, because I think we need the voice of people like Pat. So that, when I think back to the programs I've run, I've always tried to have both those that involve medication and those that involve simply intensive, sort of life-changing, character-changing kind of intense treatment, like Phoenix House and Daytop. When I started my first treatment program back in 68, I started sort of one of each. I started a therapeutic community, I started a methadone program, outpatient clinic, storefront. Very quickly we got into antagonist therapy.
Yeah.
And I've always had a soft spot in my heart for the drug-free, the therapeutic community. In fact, before we found a place for them to stay, they stayed in my house in New Haven. When my kids were young, I would drop them off on weekends. My 8 and 9-year-olds would spend a Saturday afternoon at our Daytop facility playing with the dogs and cats, and the patients would sort of be adopting them. And when my oldest daughter was 13 or 14, she was taking part in groups at Daytop. And I think in one sense that helped my kids, not to get into trouble with drugs, because you always worry, the daughter of the son of the policeman becomes a criminal, and the daughter of the minister is promiscuous. So what are the kids of a drug expert going to do?
Yes.
How do you help them to rebel in other ways than by taking drugs? And I always felt that was good for them to meet the people in our program. Spring vacations, they might work at our methadone programs. So I wanted to take the glamour, the mystery, out of drug addiction. I wanted them to meet people who've been through it. But given the fact that there are many people like Pat, and Mitch Rosenthal, who runs Phoenix House, and now Phoenix House has about 6,000 beds in the United States. These long-term TC beds. Clearly, there are people who manage to get off drugs and remain off drugs and not need maintenance therapy. So how does that happen? Can you change the brain other ways? Well, in some of the research in psychotherapy, it looks like that some of the psychotherapeutic interventions can change the brain in OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, and that you could produce with the right kind of therapy some of the same brain changes as you can produce with drugs. So it's possible that this holy grail that we're looking for is more than simply a pharmacologic fix. Mm-hmm. It could be a mixture of pharmacology and behavioral intervention, or it could be the behavioral intervention alone. I mean, I think it would be wrong to think that we must have medications. I mean, most of my research has been on medications, but I've always tried to work also on behavioral interventions. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about the contribution some of my Yale staff did, you know, Kathy Carroll with the cognitive behavioral therapy in cocaine abuse, Bruce Rounseville with his IPT. We've always tried to say, you know, it isn't simply the medications. Medications may be important. It'll always be a role, I think, for both. But medications may be more helpful in some ways because you can treat more people quickly.
Yeah.
You don't need to be as skilled to give buprenorphine as you do to give good CBT.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I wouldn't mind ending there unless you think of anything I didn't ask. Or all right.
No, as these careers go on for a long time, and these interviews can go on for a long time, but I think you have enough on the public record of
yes
of me and as you know the interview, the ACNP interview.
Yes.
So
great. Thank you.
I appreciate your time.
Yeah.